So it was a not-so-glorious England defeat at the Oval, which wrapped up the Ashes, a final score of 3-2, which nobody predicted, but turned out to be one of the more bizarre series of recent times. Seth and Lizzie are here to mull it over with me, and I kind of don't want to look back at the Oval, because just to take that one test kind of seems a bit ridiculous when we need to look at the series almost as a whole. I call it bizarre. Lizzie, what are you... Is there a better word that you can come up with for this series than bizarre?
No, I think bizarre sums it up. I mean, what we saw was two teams who were trying to out-collapse each other, and it just happened to be that England collapsed one fewer times than the others.
Yeah, and Seth, I mean, when it comes down to it, England have won the Ashes. They'll be absolutely delighted, and of course, that's what they were aiming for at the start of the series, but I don't think anybody was predicting it would quite work out the way it did.
No, and you're right, it's been bizarre, hasn't it? We talked about how, you know, the bowling attacks were going to probably be the difference throughout the course of the series, but also, I don't think any of us anticipated the poor batsmanship that was on show from both sides for long periods of time. And I think that both squads have got to kind of have a look at themselves and decide, OK, how are we going to now recharge, revamp and redesign ourselves for the future, because England can't bat that way this winter. They've got two big test series coming up, and I just don't see them being successful away from England if they bat like that. And I think they just have to find a way to at times be a little bit more pragmatic. And you know what, I'd quite like to watch the fifth day of a test match every once in a while.
Yeah, it would be nice, wouldn't it? It feels like a while since we've seen one, even though it was only, what, the New Zealand matches? I think we had a fifth day there, didn't we? So it wasn't that long ago. It's been exciting, though, hasn't it, Lizzie? I mean, come on, when the ball is king over the bat, even though the matches are short, they don't half-pack a punch.
Well, we've had exciting sessions and we've had a bit of trauma, but what we haven't had is any real tension, have we? We haven't had any nail-biting... No. Oh, which way is it going to go? Which way is it going to go? I mean, there've been Trent Bridge was decided on the first morn by 11:30. I mean, there was no, and I think it's a shame for Ashes cricket if we're going to perpetually see series that aren't nail biters, and we haven't seen a nail biter for a while, have we?
No, I have to say I'm still gutted at missing that first morning session at Trent Bridge because I was finishing a night shift. It's one of the only bits of the cricket I've missed this summer, and merely, you know, watching it later, it was great. It just wasn't quite the same as watching it live. Look, let's go through the kind of the English batting order, because I think that's one way of looking at it and you know, talking about the series more generally. Let's start at the top. Do you want to go good or bad to start off with, Seth?
Well, let's start at number one. Why not? And I will quite happily hold my hands up and say I was wrong, and Lizzie, I think you were probably right on Adam Lyth. I think that he didn't develop in the way I anticipated over the series. And the worrying thing for me is the mistakes he made in his final Ashes innings were the same mistakes he made earlier in the summer. And that for me is, that's a worry, because that's not a batsman who is changing his game to up the level. And I think in the end that will probably cost him his place on the winter tour.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think, well, he knows he's done. You could see the way he was walking off. They've given him seven tests. Seven tests is a decent run at it. I don't think he can feel hard done by if he doesn't go on the tour, and I'm pretty sure he won't. I think he just didn't... I thought he might find a way to battle through the Ashes cauldron and deal with the pressure. He just didn't find a way. That's not to say he might never, ever again, but I think he's done for the moment.
I think we could all probably agree, Seth, that he's had a better series, or probably his best series ever as captain. Batting-wise, he's looked in nick, but he's only really got 250s to show for it.
Yeah, and he had a bit of misfortune, that wonderful shot that Voges somehow managed to catch in his elbows, his shirt, whatever it was. I mean, he's had a series where, what, he's managed to face the best part of 730 balls, and he hasn't put up the runs that maybe he would have wanted. But I think Alistair Cook, to me, took a huge stride forward this summer as a captain, as a person. I was just watching one of the clips, you know, from the press conference after the other day, and Joe Root was kind of taking the mickey out of something that he'd said. And I think Alistair Cook always has looked so starchy and so stiff in media opportunities, but he kind of had the opportunity to give a tiny little bit back, and he kind of did that. And I think that the outer side of the world, and I don't know what it was like on the inside, and maybe Lizzie's got more insight on that than me, but my gut feeling is the rest of the world has started to respect Alistair Cook a little bit as a captain for what he's done in this series and for what he's done this summer. So I think that's a huge stride forward, and I think that's going to stand him in really good stead for the rest of the winter.
It's very interesting. He certainly has become a much better captain because he's doing all the things that he was criticised for not doing when there was all question marks over whether he should be backed as captain. It was really interesting in 13, whenever the whitewash was, 13, 14, he was asked the direct question, do you ever talk to ex-England captains? There were loads of them here. There's Nasser, there's Athers, there's blah, blah, blah. And he said, oh, no, we don't. And that's when Flower was in charge. We don't talk outside the group, really. We don't have newspapers and this and the other. And then recently they've invited all these ex-players into the change room just to talk to them and have a chat with them. I think Farbrace has been a revelation. And I think he's just become a different guy, really, in terms of being more open and a bit less stubborn. I mean, his stubbornness is one of the things that's got him through and kept him here. But equally, it has been his undoing in the past. But it also, I don't think you can be in a dressing room with the likes of Joe Root, Mark Wood, Ben Stokes, Joss, etc., and not have their infectious personalities rub off on you a bit, and their kind of lightheartedness rub off on you a bit, and I think it really has.
Should we be criticising Alistair Cook, though, for the way that he acted previously? If you, as you say, you know, you're talking about Farbrace coming in, having that whole new kind of attitude in the changing room, and maybe that's actually come from Flower, and he's the one that's caused the problems here, because, you know, as you mentioned, we've now got a situation where the old players are coming back in. They're invited in for a glass of wine or whatever it was with Beefy and all of that. It makes for a far more relaxed dressing room, one more willing to take on ideas, and maybe that's
all of those problems towards the end of the Flower's reign was because it became such a them and us. It became such an insular, inward looking. The world is out to get us. We're going to just pull our drawbridge up, and we're going to stay as a bubble. And that's what led to the downfall of Flower and that sort of regime. Bayliss and Farbrace. I mean, Trevor Farbrace. Not Trevor Farbrace. I've done a hybrid there. Paul Farbrace. He's just not a guy. He's not a guy who cares about kind of going through protocols before you talk to him about the media and stuff. He just thinks that's all bullshit, if you'll excuse the French. He just talks. He's just a bloke who talks.
But don't you think part of that's down to the fact of who he was as a cricketer and the fact that he had no airs and graces as a cricketer, and he's somebody that maybe doesn't have the background where he felt that he had to live in some kind of cocoon. He's somebody that made his money being a meat and potatoes player. He's a guy that had to work hard every single day to play the first class game. And as a coach, he's had to go and do exactly the same thing to get his respect. And I'm not dismissing what Andy Flower did, but I think that maybe one of the things he did very, very well was stand up to people who kind of crossed him. And that was as a player. He did it against the authorities in Zimbabwe. And I think then, as a coach with England, he was somebody that stood up to people that he felt could potentially damage his team. And in the end, that just leads to you living in a bubble. And it's a bubble that becomes counterproductive. And I think there's a certain naivety to Alistair Cook. And he wasn't somebody who'd spent a lot of time captaining, as that's not going to happen at international level anymore. So I think that Alistair Cook was somebody that kind of very much just followed the line. And he would never just take one step back and say, well, hang on a second, why are we doing this? And I think that's what the new coaching setup has allowed them all to do. It's ask them a question. All right, why are we doing this? What is it that's going to make you better? We'll talk into that person or this person. Well, why don't you do it? And I think the big answer to that is, well, because that's how we've been doing it. And all of a sudden, that just changes the wheel. The wheel rotates and everything just turns around a little bit. And I think it's opened Alistair Cook's eyes.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a difficult winter for him. There are some real challenges coming up, and quite how he manages his personnel in the UAE when he's going to have to work out how to bowl two spinners in the UAE. It's going to be another challenge for him, and it'll be interesting to see how he goes with that. I think he's much more able to make off-the-cuff decisions rather than formulate ones. I think we've seen that more this series, and that's really encouraging. He's never going to be Brendan McCullum, and that's all right. He doesn't need to be.
Just skipping the batting order a little bit, I mean, it has kind of pushed the idea that we all thought was going to happen at the start of the series, that Joe Root would step up to become England captain now. That's kind of gone off the agenda a bit, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's probably a good thing. I think I don't think there's any harm at all in Joe Root, you know, doing what he does. I think it won't be long before he is the number three batsman. I mean, Bell's already slightly intimated that he's considering his future, I think is the way he put it. And when Bell goes, I think it probably will be Root who comes into three, don't you?
I would think so. Yeah. I mean, it's your best player, isn't it, is the one who goes to three. And I think I said this a couple of podcasts ago. That's the way the Australians have pretty much always done it. And you've got to look at, you know, the team we've got at the moment. Everyone thought maybe at the start of the series, well, Bell is the classic player who should be at three. Well, actually, now you look at it and you go, no, it's Joe Root, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, Bell Root did it. What am I talking about?
Bell Root. Good Lord.
Please do send us your other cricketing hybrids by Twitter.
Ian Bell did do. I mean, he did his job at Edgbaston, didn't he? He was moved up to three there after the dropping of Gary Balance. And he did a job there. The shot he got out to in the second innings was one of those ones that you just put your head in your hands. But he did his job there, and that experiment probably worked. To put him up there. But if he's not going to have a long future, it will be Joe Root who comes to number three. And if he's going to number three, I'm not sure you then want to put the captaincy on him as well. So it's probably not a bad thing that he's going to have a couple of years wait, maybe, or 18-month wait before he takes that job on.
I really want to get to the situation now in the England team where we've got Bell Root, Bell Drummond. Can we have someone else as well?
The player I'm looking forward to seeing is Sachin Warne. You know, I think that Sachin Warne could do a bit of everything, couldn't he?
Wouldn't be bad, would it? Let's go back to number three in the actual running order, batting order, I should say, at the start, which was Gary Balance at the start of the series, who's gone away, gone back to Yorkshire, and got
a few
runs.
I've just been there. I've just watched him get a century at Hove. I was covering that match and spoke to him afterwards. He'll be back. He definitely will be back. I think I'm already hearing signs that they're probably going to take him on tour. He's sensibly come to the conclusion himself, and he's very much a type of player who needs to work things out for himself, that his problems with batting too deep in the crease are something he needs to work on. He's doing it slowly but surely. I don't think you mess around with your technique. You know, I don't think you dramatically change it. I don't think that helps anyone, but he is working on it. There were signs that he was coming a bit further forward and not getting quite as, albeit against county attack, I admit, But I think he will be back quite where he fits in. Not quite sure at the moment, but I think Balance will be around the England squad.
Is there an argument, Lizzie, that we're going to develop into a situation, which I don't think would be a bad thing, where you get batsmen who come in and out of form? You know, so you have a nucleus, say, of 16 players for your England team, tops. And those batsmen who just, you know, in and out of form, those are the ones who go back to the county, get a few runs, come back in the England team, and so on.
Well, that would sound entirely sensible to me, James. Therefore, it won't happen.
Excellent.
no, but I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there is nothing wrong. I think what we saw with Balance was he had just had a really rough time, and his technique was being questioned, and it was under the scrutiny. And he's a good player. He's a good batsman. You know, that was his 26th first-class century. And what is he, 24, 25? I mean, yeah. He's got, you know, you don't get 26 first-class centuries by being a Muppet, do you?
I'm a Muppet, and I definitely haven't got 26 first-class centuries. I can tell you that much. Number four, and then number three in the order, was Ian Bell this summer, and we touched on him very briefly. Looks as though he might be considering his future. He's still a classy player, but Seth, he's not getting the runs, is he? And actually, is it fair to say that he's not actually looked in as good nick this summer as we'd expect?
Well, I think he very rarely looks out of nick. you know, completely out of nick. He scored 215 runs in 382 balls. What that tells me is he's not batting for long enough. He's somebody that should be taking up overs, and he should be taking time at the crease, because when he does that, you know, he doesn't have to score a century in a session. He doesn't have to swashbuckle his way in a way that maybe a Ben Stokes or a Joss Butler would, because that's their natural game. He has the technique to take his time, you know. I would like to see him go to the UAE, because I think he does play spin, you know, relatively well. I think that he moves his feet, he tries to get on the front foot and tries to attack a little bit the spin. However, you know, these big yahoos, I just don't understand his thinking in this series. And he's got into positions, and maybe, you know, when we all look back on Ian Bell's career, we'll talk about him being a wonderful batsman who at his best was as elegant as they come. However, and maybe this is just me, I will always feel a slight pang of, you know what, he should have been the number one batsman in the world for a period of time. But he never did it because he never really valued his wicket highly enough. And I think that's kind of my negative on him in this series. I think that too often he got himself in positions and then gave it away.
I was just going to say, is he like this generation's Gower? We always say that Gower, you know, Moeen plays like Gower because he's beautiful, he's left-handed and blah, blah. But actually, Ian Bell, you know, would play some beautiful innings, but doesn't stick in the crease in the same way as, I know, maybe Graham Cooch would have liked David Gower to have done all those years ago.
Well, I think that Ian Bell is afforded more... he's given a bit more licence, isn't he, because he's elegant. I think if he was an ugly player and got the same stats, I think he'd have been out of the side.
Yeah.
We're going back to the first podcast here, aren't we, when I was sitting in that sushi bar in Barcelona.
I'll get you.
No, but we were. I mean, this was a subject we talked about, the fact that... You know, Ian Bell kind of as flies under the radar so often because he very rarely looks out of nick, and he always looks quite good.
Yeah. I mean, he's averaged 26 in the... I mean, admittedly, all the averages look ridiculously low because it's been such a ridiculous series, but he's averaged 26 in a five-match series. It's not good enough, is it?
And if you take that over a longer period of time, you know, how many series in the last 3 years has he averaged over 40? I think, it might be the last 2 years, I think there's only one series he's averaged over 40, which, for somebody who's as good as him, isn't good enough. And the longer period of time will tell you that he's somebody who's been on the decline for whatever reason. And, you know, that's a big worry. Though I would like to see him go on the tour this winter. You know, I would like to see one final opportunity.
It feels harsh to do this, but I'm almost going to skip over Joe Root, unless you want to say anything particular, because... He's been the one standout player, really, for England. A couple of silly dismissals, but a couple of beautiful innings. In some cases, won the game for us. I think certainly in Cardiff, he was absolutely crucial. He's just been fantastic, hasn't he?
He's rate good. Move on.
I don't think there's much else to add.
No, well, exactly.
I mean,
so
just,
what about his Yorkshire colleague, Johnny Bairstow, came in, having scored tons in the county championship, literally tons, and hasn't yet again really shown it, maybe at test level. Is that a bit harsh, do you think?
He got 70 off, didn't he? I mean, I think he looks good. I just can't quite see where he fits in long term.
He doesn't look like a top order player, does he, ever? I mean, even a solid middle order. You always think he's going to be at number 5 or 6 and he's going to stay there forever.
Yeah, I don't quite know what we do with Johnny Bairstow, but then that intertwines with the Joss Butler discussion we're going to have, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, and he's next in the big list, and we've got some great questions to at the drinks break, so we appreciate all of those. Cyril Washbrook, now there's a name for the ages, says to us, Butler's inability to dig in is because of a lack of championship matches. Discuss.
I don't think it is. I think it's just it's not what he is, and that's not his job either.
Seth?
Completely agree, yeah. I think he hasn't played tons of championship cricket, and I think that there was such a clamour to try and get him into the test side after he played so well in the shorter forms of the game. I think that maybe we were all expecting an awful lot of him, and his technique has been... well, it's been questioned, hasn't it? It has given us questions as to what he needs to do. I think the bonus a little bit for England is they have two pretty similar players. And, you know, as Lizzie mentioned, there's Bairstow and there's Butler. Both of them have that ability to be able to play as a 6/7, and they could potentially win you a game in a session. And, you know, wicket-keeping-wise, is there a lot in them? I don't think there necessarily is. I think they're pretty close. Neither of them would be described as wonderful glove men of the ages. However, both of them probably do an adequate job within the modern game behind the stumps because of what they give you with the bat as well. And I think it's going to be a fascinating next one-day series and then a fascinating winter where, particularly in the UAE, when they're going to have to stand up to the stumps and have potentially 40, 50 overs of spin a day, you know, how are they going to be able to deal with that? Because this will be so new.
I think Butler plays spin better than Bairstow, from what I've seen. Or he certainly does in limited overs cricket, although it's slightly different spin, isn't it? It's more sort of darts than turning. Yeah. I think Butler's ability to innovate with his shots will stand him in good stead against the spin, or at least it should do. It's all, you know, it's going to be interesting what England do to try and balance the side, because they've got to get two spinners in. So something's going to have to give. Someone's going to have to shift, aren't they? And it's perhaps it's Moeen Ali up to the top, and that makes room for Rashid or AN other. But it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because somewhere along the line, a batsman's got to go to make room for a second spinner.
Well, James,
just six runs between them as well, you know, during the series between the two potential wicket keepers, Bairstow and Butler, and you know that kind of tells the story on its own, doesn't it? That Bairstow had the better of the series, really, because he had the one knock which helped England get themselves in a really good position.
My favourite question we've been asked at the drinks break so far comes from James Ash. If the answer is Moeen Ali opening the batting, what is the question?
What do you... Why are we going to the UAE is the question.
Well, it's a good one, isn't it? I mean, look, is Moeen Ali going to open the batting? Is that a sensible question? Or should we be looking, as Paul Morrell suggests, presuming Live is dropped, do you think Hales is a better option than pushing Moeen up as a stopgap here, Lizzie? What's the shout? What are they going to do in the UAE?
Well, there are plenty of times when I think I could be a selector, I could do a better job. This is not one of those times. I do not envy them at all. It's a really difficult one. We know Moeen opens at Worcestershire. Moeen is a very, very good batsman. Is he the England's opener for the next 2, 3, 5 years? He's not, is he?
No. Especially if they want him to be the spinner.
Who exactly? That's a heck of a responsibility. Who is England's opener? And we've got to pick one, and we've got to decide on it, and we've got to go with him for the winter. And is it Moeen? I just don't know. But I am. I mean, I like Hales. I think Hales can play spin. I think people say he can't, but I think he can. I think he's done enough to warrant a place on the plane, at least. And then leave it to the coach when you get out there to sort it out. Pick your names as a selector and then go on, Trevor, it's your job.
Boycott was making... I was just going to say, Seth, Boycott was making quite a good... Well, you know, obviously a good point on TMS, which was... He said Alex Hales will do quite well in Pakistan or in the UAE against Pakistan because he plays off the front foot and in terms of spin, he'll be fine. But when he gets to South Africa and he's playing against Dale Steyn, he could have a few problems, which Matthew Woolbridge has tweeted us and said, you know, what would be your starting 11 for the first test in South Africa? We'll come to that in a bit.
Well, Hales has got a problem against the short ball, but not as much as Moeen has. Moeen gets himself in the wrong position against short balls. He gets himself tucked up and the bat is up in front of his face, so it's going to leap off the shoulder of it. Now, Moeen is a fantastic, elegant batsman, but he does have a problem against the short ball. People will try and tell you he doesn't, his biggest fans, but he does. That's not, you know, it's not... It's, lots of people have problems against the short balls. All over the place, batsmen have problems against the short ball. So Pakistan, probably it's fine, but it's right. South Africa, who is going to cope with Morney Morkel and Dale Steyn firing it out?
Well, the other question I was going to ask as part of that is, you know, Adam Live is the name that's jumped out from the county championship over the last few years. He's been elevated to test level, hasn't seemingly got it at the moment anyway. Is there anybody else in the county championship that you've seen who's even barely knocking on the door?
I'm going to throw in a curveball.
Why not?
Daryl Mitchell. Yeah, that's shut
yeah.
you up, isn't it?
I don't know what to say to that.
Tumbleweed.
It's not. It's only half serious, but
make the case. Go on, make the case.
Well, he's a very, very accomplished batsman against all different types of bowling. I mean, he's not going to be. He's not young enough, and he's not the future, and this and the other. But he's an opener who gets a lot of runs. I know that, and he's got runs in Division One this year. So, you know, that's all I'm saying.
Do you think this is?
But there's not a great Richard Pickings.
Do you think this is a position that they're going to end up picking based on a mixture of gut instinct and somebody with the right character, rather than necessarily the technical ability to open in the way that we perceive people should be able to do?
I think they absolutely have to now pick on gut instinct, and they have to see, in the way they did with Vaughan and Triscothic, who didn't have great county averages by any stretch of the imagination, did they? Just someone you can see. I tell you who else I think, not probably for this winter, but will be, Daniel Bell Drummond. Daniel Bell Drummond at Kent has got something about him that makes me think that he will make the step up should he need to, even if he doesn't have a brilliant county average and it be a Division 2-1. There's something about him.
What about Joey and Bell Root? I've heard he's quite good.
Well, imagine Bell Drummond to Bell Root.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That'll do.
I can only imagine what Henry Blofeld would do with that.
That would be...
He would be tolling out his lines, wouldn't he?
Rather entertaining, to say the least. Look, let's...
What about Alex Lees? I think it's too early this series.
He's not had a good... He's had a quiet season. He's had that sort of second album syndrome, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has completely, but he's the guy that they've kind of anointed, haven't they?
Yeah, he's going on the Lions tour. He'll go on the Lions tour, and I think the Lions are with them in the UAE, and then they branch off to India when England go to South Africa, but I think that they very much have him. You know, he'll be in the Lions, and therefore, once you're in the Lions, you're not very far away, are you?
If you want to make a little bet right now, I will say that Alex Lees will open the first Test of next season. So the first Test of the next English summer, I bet you he'll be there or thereabouts if he has a good winter, because I just don't see the scenario with the players they've got available. I don't see the solution that's going to see them through the UAE. And then see them through South Africa. I think you pick one that will do the UAE. I think you're absolutely knackered for South Africa. And then you look at it all over again. I mean, you know, potentially for the UAE, one of the things they could do, and you're all going to laugh when I say this, you could open with Joe Root there, because the pitches aren't going to do a great deal. And he's somebody that is capable of playing, you know, in that opening slot. They won't do it, but that maybe would be a better way. I think he's a better prepared batsman than Moeen Ali to take on the new
but we
ball
shouldn't,
because he's done it a lot more throughout his
we
career.
We shouldn't underestimate Pakistan's attack, though, should we? I mean, you know, you've got players like Wahab Riaz. They are pretty good, both with seam and spin.
Yeah, but it's the pitches just aren't conducive in the same way in the UAE. From what I understand, I'm not somebody that has spent an awful lot of time in the UAE watching cricket, but my understanding is the pitches there will turn, but they're not going to be leaping off a length and flying through at nose height every day. I mean, I'm quite happy if somebody's going to tell me differently.
No, they won't carry. They won't be the Gabba or anything, will they? But I mean, there is the possibility that Mohammed Amir might be in, isn't there?
My great annoyance is that my friend, who lives about a mile from the stadium in Abu Dhabi, has friends and family over that week, so I can't go stay on his floor and watch the cricket. It's very annoying.
It's very inconsiderate.
Very inconsiderate of him, to say the least. Let's carry on with our little look at the batting order. I've kind of skipped one to talk about Moeen Ali. Let's talk about his bowling for a second. He hasn't done as well, has he, as he did against India last season, but he's just about kept his end up.
12 wickets out of 45. I mean, he's been expensive, but they were always going to go after him, weren't they? They saw him as the person they were going to go after. So whilst they were going after him, he had a chance of taking wickets. He did take a fifer. I thought he bowled all right, but, you know, the way the matches went, when England were on top, he didn't, you know, he was a little bit redundant, wasn't he, in a sense, with, you know, when they've got the seamers rattling through them, he's not. There's never going to be a chance for him to bowl in the second innings or get an extended spell.
100%. I mean, what did Moeen do in the Trent Bridge test? I'll tell you what he did. He ran from fine leg to fine leg.
Yeah.
To fine leg to fine leg. And, you know, did that absolutely wonderfully well. But that's not going to help you. And what we really need to see more of from him is, and we're going to see in the UAE, what's he going to do when England needs somebody to bowl 25 overs of spin and be that wicket-taking bowler? Can he do that?
Well,
when conditions are conducive, and that's always going to be the question mark, isn't
well,
it? Until he's done it consistently.
If you are going to play two spinners, you want one of them to be the tying down, and probably the off spinner to be the one who ties them down and holds an end up, and the leggy to be the one who may go for runs but take the wickets, possibly. I mean, and if you're going to have Moeen and Adil in the same team, you would think that Adil turning it both ways, getting more turn than Moeen does, maybe more likely, and getting a bit of bounce and what have you, maybe more likely to take the wickets, but he'll go for runs. But Moeen isn't really a tie and end down bowler, is he?
No. Is it definitely going to be Adil Rashid?
Not definitely, no. I mean, no, they'll take three spinners for a start, won't they? They'll need to.
So who's going
to
be that third spinner? I mean, are we going back to a...
God knows.
Kerrigan, a Borthwick?
No, we're not going
back to James Treadwell, are we?
I mean, when I watched the rain, I did sit and look at the bowling averages across the two divisions, and I was like, oh my word, there really isn't anyone.
No.
I mean, they might have to think about going for a young raw one. I don't know, I mean, a really young raw one. And maybe just take a punt, or you go for a Gareth Batty.
And I'm going to completely throw a name in from left field, hasn't been talked about for a while. Is it worth the punt of going to Monty and going, you know, you are still the best spinner we've
got? No. He's only just got back in the Essex time. He did take a few wickets, but he's not there between the ears. I mean, at the moment, he's not in the right mental frame of mind to be going back in that cauldron.
Fair enough. But there's nobody else on the county scene. You've gone, you know, you'd have a punter as a young raw player,
well,
as you suggest?
There are young raw spinners. There's Mason Crane, there's Josh Poisden, there's Adam Riley, but Andrew Salter, Kieran Bull. There are lots of young spinners because these lads are not stupid. They've worked out that there's no spinners. And they're more likely to get in a side if they are spinners rather than batsmen. So there's lots of them about, but they're all very, very young and very raw.
Well, it'll be an interesting decision to see who they come up with. Let's go back to our little batting order. We've kind of skipped one to go and talk about Moeen, who, brilliant with the bat as he was, sometimes was eclipsed by Ben Stokes, one above him, who was just fabulous with bat. I mean, this has been his series, hasn't it, Seth?
Yeah, I think it probably has in many respects. It's been interesting, hasn't it, to just see how that's all developed. And I've been impressed.
He's a fabulous, fabulous cricketer and a fabulous character. And he is what he is. He got three ducks, didn't he? He didn't get a century, but I mean, he's only averaging 25 with the bat, but that's all right. What did he get? He got 11 wickets. Some really important wickets as well. I mean, his fielding has been outstanding. You're going to have Stokes in your team, aren't you?
It was worth including him for that catch, wasn't it, off Adam Verges?
Oh.
And the other thing, though, that period of that spell of bowling was just phenomenal. It was at Trent Bridge, wasn't it, where he was swinging it around corners his control. I mean, that. When you hear the comparisons, and it's not a proper comparison, but it just puts it in the mind, you know, the comparison of him and Jimmy Anderson and his ability to swing it both ways. You know, it does make you think, well, hang on a second. This kid is super, super special. And he could be in the side on either count. He's somebody who has got that ability to bowl, and he's so useful, and he gives us so much flexibility. And if he, you know, he's one of those players, again, that could prosper massively this winter because he's got that ability to swing the old ball.
Now, what about Stuart Broad, who has, it has to be said, I mean, it's been, you know, I said it was, to some extent, Stokes' series, for Broad not to get Man of the Series, officially Man of the Series, was frankly ridiculous. Because not only did he have the third best piece of bowling ever in English history against Australia, that's how good it was. He's also come back from a situation where nobody thought he could actually hold a bat anymore. And yet he's taken on Mitchell Johnson, and at times he's kind of won, hasn't he?
He has. And the other thing with Broad is that he was always accused, and with evidence to back it up, that he only really showed up kind of one in four test matches, didn't he? And then he'd have a brilliant spell and take a hat-trick and what have you, and then go missing again for a couple of... and it was only really the Oval that he didn't bowl very well at the Oval, I don't think, but the other four tests, I thought he bowled pretty well.
He did it. He did it consistently throughout the series. And, you know, even when England was struggling at Lord's, that morning session that he bowled with James Anderson, he bowled seven or eight overs of terrific seam bowling, line and length. And it just feels like he's matured. He's matured as a bloke, it seems, but also he's matured as a bowler as well. And you know, we've not seen petulant Broad, have we? We've not seen him, you know, demanding that every single appeal is reviewed in the same way that maybe he has done previously. He's been really good, and it's been a pleasure to watch. I've had the opportunity to sit down with some Canadian ice hockey players, actually, and they were asking me all about cricket. They got a bit caught up in the Ashes, and to play that spell to them,
yeah,
at Trent Bridge, it was brilliant because they got absolutely no idea what was going on. But it was wonderful to be able to try and explain what he's trying to do with the ball and exactly... because he just did it so very, very well. It was great.
I'd still hope that they, you know, name a bar after him in the Larwood and Vose Tavern, something like that. The Broad Bar, I think, for that spell would be well worth it. Let's rattle through the bowlers fairly quickly. Mark Wood has played 5 test matches, he's won the Ashes, and he's introduced a horse to English cricket. All of which is quite an achievement in your first summer. And he's been, Lizzie, a bit of a revelation.
Yeah, he has. He's just... there's a bright future, as they say. I mean, he's not bowled consistently well throughout the series. I think he's found that Ashes cricket is hard. Very, very hard. But he's going to be around. He's only taken 10 wickets, and again, living a little bit expensive, but we can see what he's got. He's got all the skills. He is only in his, well, something like 28th first class match or something ridiculous, isn't he? He's not, yeah. I mean, so there's a bright future. They'll stick with him. They like him a lot. He brings a lot to the team, both with the ball. He can bat. I mean, he can bat well, can't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you what, that ball that he delivered to David Warner to get him was something else as well. I mean, that was excellent, I thought.
Yeah.
You know, it was really, really good. And it's just great to see somebody come in with such enthusiasm into the squad, Seth.
Yeah, and he's done something different to the others, hasn't he? And he really does complement the other three seam bowlers that England have used for the majority of this series. You know, Anderson is so good at what he does. Broad has got that ability to find that extra bounce. And then he's come in and been able to swing it, and he swung it both ways, he's pitched it up. And his Yorker, I love seeing bowlers that can bowl of that length and bowl that ball particularly, and he did it so well. And it's a good wicket taker for him, and he's still developing. He's still a little bit naive at times, I think. The other thing he does maybe better than the other England bowlers is he uses the full width of the crease, doesn't he? And that just changes his angle. And it really does make him difficult. And when the going's going to be tough this winter, I've got two questions about him. Number one is, will his body stand up to being able to bowl the number of overs in a day that may be required? And will he be able to, you know, get that little bit stronger and confident enough in himself that he can still get the ball down at 85 plus at 5:30 in the evening as he can at 11 o'clock in the morning? And I think also... you know, through a whole series, he needs to now be able to pitch up Test 1, Test 2, Test 3, Test 4, Test 5, if he possibly can. Because I think, again, that's going to be his next step as an international player, isn't it? And his next step of development as a cricketer. Can he just make sure that the problems he had of injury are going to be managed, and international cricket, actually, despite the fact they all talk about playing so much, which they do, particularly if you play every format, which again, I expect he probably will as well, he can manage the body, and they're going to have the right people working at him, doing the right things to really strengthen that core and really make sure that for him, he's not going to go through the injury problems he had in the early part of his career.
Yeah, and the last two I want to mention, the last two in the list are Stephen Finn and James Anderson. And I wonder if this series has, if not seen the passing of the baton, it's kind of been a note to England's future, hasn't it, Lizzie? Stephen Finn is back and he looks like a proper bowler again.
Oh, isn't it heartwarming? It's just, I mean, what a lovely tale. I think it was really important when Anderson, it was almost, you know, when I see anyone injured, but actually it was a really important that Anderson missed a test, and a test that England then went on to win, because it demonstrates that we're going to be all right. We, England, are going to be all right without him, you know. And there was a real, you know, he was so reliant on him. That actually it was a kind of that whole, oh no, got to wrap Jimmy in cotton wool because we'll never manage without him. We'll be fine without him when he does finally retire. Finn has fought, I mean, what a top bloke. He has just fought his way. He's fought his way back. And we interviewed him last week, week before the Oval Test. Very interesting to hear him talk about a slight change in his grip, so that he could get the away swinger that he couldn't really get. He could always get reverse swing, but he could never quite get the prodigious traditional swing, a particularly away swing. And he just changed something a little bit and been working on it with Johnson, the bowling coach of Middlesex. Tried it at Edgbaston. Brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, that's the list of England players. We could go on to Australia, do the same thing. Wouldn't be a good idea because we'd be here for another 45 minutes at least, and I've got to get up in the morning. But a biggish mouth on Twitter said to us, who would be your top five batsmen in a combined Ashes 11? And that's, you know, quite interesting, isn't it? Because it's quite difficult to come up with that top five. Because, I mean, have you got five you can pick from?
Well,
just
definitely, you definitely have Smith and Root, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Yeah, they're in, and then your openers, I have to say, would probably be the Aussie ones, wouldn't they? I know Chris Rogers has retired, but let's say he hasn't.
I'd go Cook and Rogers.
Would you?
Yeah, I think I would, yeah. If my life depended on something, I would want those two to go and knock the shine off the ball.
You wouldn't want your life depending on this sort of decision, would you?
Well, I wouldn't want my life depending on Warner. I know that. I know that much, because as entertaining as he is for me, I just couldn't rely on him losing my life on holding out at cover. That would really upset me. It would be a terrible way to go. So, yeah, I think that Cook and Rogers would be my opening pair. I then think I would do a Joe Root at three, Smith at four, and would I'd probably maybe even consider Stokes at five.
I was just about to say that. You're a bit lacking on number five, so let's elevate Stokes.
I'm afraid I'll go slightly differently for you. I would go with Rogers and Cook at the top. Warner at three, Smith at four, Root at five. Thank you very much.
That's interesting.
I think that would do me quite happily. Finally, on this part, One Tip One Hand says, was this the worst Ashes series ever?
Mm,
I mean,
no.
I should point out, I sat through most of the 90s series. So from that perspective, no, it wasn't.
Yeah.
But it has been... It hasn't been very good in terms of watchability, almost, has it? As you said at the start, Lizzie, there's been no tension.
No,
it's just swung from side to side, bizarrely.
Yeah, it has. And whilst that's kind of brought really, really dramatic moments, and obviously an England Ashes win against all the odds, what the concern I have is that it papers a win for England papers over some of the cracks and some of the problems. It also papers over the fact that Ashes always do, that all is not right with cricket. Cricket isn't well, and Ashes series tend to paint the picture that it is, and that there's full stadiums and everything's great and there's so much coverage and it's all fantastic, and you know, we get great big broadcast deals and what have you,
the whole Ashes kind of hype for me is a real part of the problem that we have in the bigger picture in cricket, is that everything is about the Ashes and there's a whole heap of other cricket goes on.
I should ask, how was the Change Cricket protest at the Oval?
Well, it was, I mean, it was what it was intended to be. It was a sort of, you know, 100 and something people loitering around the gates with banners and what have you. But it was important. In, it got some coverage. It got Damien Collins, the MP, down, who was asked questions and said that he wanted to get the Sports Select Committee, Parliament Sports Select Committee, to get Giles Clarke to come in front of them and you know, account for some of his decisions. And that's important. I mean, you know, it was what it was. It's not going to, you know, I can't imagine any Srinivasan shaking in his boots in his office in Dubai. But, you know, it's the start of a process, really.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see where we go from here. Right, I kind of want to round up that bit of the podcast there with the Ashes reaction. Let's look ahead to the One Day Internationals. Rhys Topley is in. James Vince is in. Johnny Bairstow's out, Lizzie. And that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me.
Make any sense to me. I mean, I think there's obviously a lot of competition for those middle order spots, and I happen to know that the selectors were in their meeting for a long time this morning because I was waiting for them to come out of it so that I could interview Liam Plunkett and Chris Jordan. In the end, I didn't wait for them. I just interviewed Liam Plunkett and Chris Jordan on the basis that they might get the nod, and then I felt really awful when Chris Jordan didn't get the nod because I'd interviewed him saying congratulations on your anyway, it's fine, he understood. But I guess it's just a case of there being too many people and not enough slots.
Seth, what do you make of Johnny Bairstow's omission?
Oh, mad. He's madness. You know, he's somebody that if you're going to pick him in any form of the game, you probably pick him in the one-day squad or the 2020 squad first, don't you? That's where his skills at the international level have been shown to be best. And he's been in very good form so far this season. I mean, to be honest, as a Yorkshire fan, I'm delighted that he's not going to be playing for England, and there's more chance of him playing for Yorkshire in the final push. But yeah, I would have always included him. Always nice to hear new names included in the squad as well. And I think that this is always going to be the case, isn't it? You know, they're going to rest players at the end of tough series and tough summers, and I know that some get a bee in the bonnet about it not being the best England side out there, but hey, you know,
really rested Root, haven't they? Actually, I think it's a bit of a nod to the fact that England are starting to take one-day cricket really very seriously, that they have only rested Root. They haven't rested Stokes, and I thought they might. He's played a lot of cricket too, and has got a hefty winter coming up. So actually, I think...
But if you look at the bowling attack is probably going to change by two or three players, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas previously, what they would do is, you know, they would end up... I mean, it's more natural for that to happen because of the side that played against New Zealand, where they changed it a lot, and Broad and Anderson didn't play in that. So there isn't as much change now, which is unnatural. There's not going to be no Cook at the top of the order. There's going to be no Lyth at the top of the order. So there is going to be a big change from the test team. But I just think that shows the swing for England to having two completely different setups.
Yeah, and that's it's got to be that way. It just has to be that way, doesn't it? I mean, I would have liked to see Craig Overton in there.
Yeah, agree.
Because I think he's a very exciting player. I really hope that James Taylor makes the 11 because the poor bloke just has to... I've just got to wonder what else the poor bloke's got to do, really, hasn't he? But he's in and hopefully he'll make the 11. It's an exciting-looking one-day squad, and I think it'll be a pretty exciting series, really, actually.
I think all James Taylor needs to do is start wearing stilts and he'll probably get in the team, as ridiculous as that is. Lizzie, we also had the Women's Ashes, and we've kind of left it to the end because it seems all but over, really. It's going to take a bit of a miracle now, isn't it?
Well, they're going to need to win all three T20s. Yeah. That is a long shot. They played well. They just weren't very good in the Test match. I mean, there's no way of putting a positive spin on it. They were pretty garbage. Really poor batting. Some pretty average captaincy from Charlotte Edwards. And a real there's a real debate to be had, A, about whether women should even be playing Test cricket, and my view is they shouldn't at the moment until we've got a more even structure in professionalism all the way through the game. They don't play any long-form cricket, and they don't play with a red ball other than in Test cricket. We're setting them up for a bit of a fall. I don't see what value it brings. I'm not sure that there was a great spectacle on the television. Fair play to Sky for showing it, but I had a lot of people tweeting me saying, I gave it a shot, sorry, it's a bit rubbish. And I have to say, it wasn't great, the Test match, I didn't think. One day cricket and T20 I think is fantastic. It's getting there, it's really interesting to watch. The Test cricket is a struggle. I'm not sure what value it brings. I'd stick a pin in it for the moment myself. Get a more professional domestic structure in place. If you're going to develop a game, you wouldn't start with the long form cricket. I've always thought that actually, if you're going to design cricket, you'd start with T20 and you'd say, look, isn't T20 great? Why don't we have a few more overs? Let's have some 50 over cricket. Look how brilliant that is. Let's play it for a few days instead, rather than the other way around, as we have done in men's cricket.
Isn't there a problem though that you will end up relegating the women's game to being essentially second tier if you don't give them the option of playing Test match cricket?
Well, I just think you've got to think pragmatically about women's cricket and not try and make it men's cricket. And you've got to think about how you get development in the game and how you get the power and the skills and make it entertaining, and therefore it can pay for itself. It starts to bring in revenue, rather than think about the sort of traditions of Test cricket. The reality is that only Australia and New Zealand and the West Indies really play Test cricket. India don't take it very seriously. New Zealand and West Indies women's cricket doesn't have very much money. There's only Australia and England, and they only play it, you know, they play one Test match every 18 months or something. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I absolutely see what you mean. I just, you know, I do think that if you reduce that option, you don't give them the chance to play Test cricket, which they barely have at the moment, then you're kind of suggesting that their game is not as important, almost, which it's a slightly self-defeating argument because it's not seen as seemingly as important by the powers that be. That shouldn't be the way it is, but that's how it appears to be seen to me.
Yeah, I don't think it is at all. I don't think that's the way it is. I don't think it's viewed like that because I think, as I say, what you need women's cricket to be is self. It brings in its revenue. It needs to be entertaining. It needs to be developed. And I'm not saying we'll never play Test cricket again, but I think if you can make women's cricket pay for itself by lots of T20 and lots of entertaining T20 and T20 leagues and this, that and the other, then you can start to have a more professional game all the way down the structures. At the moment, we've got such a disparity between the 18 centrally contracted players and those playing county cricket who don't get paid a penny. And there is a real difference. And we need to be able to have the professional structures. The Women's Super League will start to do that from next year, and that's all well and good. But I think you can't really have a serious first-class and test structure until you've got that professionalism there. So maybe, you know, 5-10 years in the future, it will be there, but it's not at the moment, and it's not. It doesn't really do anyone any good, to be honest.
I desperately want to keep this under an hour because I just feel that's a decent cut-off. So we've got 4 minutes to go through the other bits and pieces, which are, very quickly, any other business and BT Sport. Seth, they have won the rights to show the Ashes in Australia next time round. They've paid a lot of money for it. Good thing? Bad thing? What do you reckon?
Always a good thing. Whenever the Sky Empire loses out on something, because I think that it just forces them to up their game. And in the last 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, Sky have massively upped their game, and their cricket coverage is phenomenal. I think it's absolutely brilliant. But what were they pushed by? Well, they were pushed by what happened on Channel 4, and Channel 4 really worked hard, didn't they, back in 2005 with how they covered the game and the advances that they made
in
technology.
This isn't good for consumers, though, is it? Because you're now, as a cricket fan, you're going to have to buy Sky and you're going to have to buy BT as well. It's just going to cost more
money. Yeah, but BT have also got the free-to-air packages as well, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. And what they'll be doing, as I understand it, is they'll put out the Australian Big Bash on free-to-air. The Test matches won't be. Now, that puts us in the very odd position of the Australian domestic T20 competition being on free-to-air and the English one not being, which is a challenge for the ECB. I think It's good to have competition. It's good to break up monopolies. But you don't get something for nothing. And with ever-increasing bids... I mean, when 2019, when the next bidding war comes up, there's going to be bonkers bids on the table. And that only gets passed on to the consumers. We saw it with the Sky Football, didn't we? That we're all paying £3 a month extra now because you don't get something for nothing.
That's true. We'll come back to that and we'll do that in more detail at some point once the Ashes are all done. India versus Sri Lanka at the moment is 1-1 in that test series. It's been interesting to see, actually, how bad India have been at playing spin. We'll just note that for the future because that's what we imagine. They're all great, but Rangana Harath has gone through them like a dose of salt. I just want to mention very quickly, Lizzie, Chris Tremlett has retired. And
Whoa. You've moved on from India to Sri Lanka without mentioning Sangakkara has retired.
Oh, that's a good point.
Come on, Sangakkara can take us over the hour.
Go on, Sanga. Well, we bow down.
I mean, thankfully, we're going to still be able to see him at the Oval playing for Surrey, aren't we?
Well, so seemingly, he's going to be the new High Commissioner to Britain for Sri Lanka. Now, there's an offer you don't expect at the end of your career.
No, but I mean, just what a wonderful, wonderful player and a wonderful man. And I mean, if you haven't ever listened to his Spirit of Cricket lecture, then you must go and listen to it because it is the most moving thing I've ever heard. It was just incredible. What an amazing man. He'll be great to have around the English game for a bit longer. And, he went out with a bit of a damp squib, didn't he? But what a wonderful player.
So Chris Tremlett's retired then.
He hasn't done a Spirit of Cricket lecture yet.
He hasn't, not yet. But he was brilliant, wasn't he? Just in a small patch, he wasn't brilliant.
He was quite good, but he wasn't brilliant. I mean, come on, he was a player who never really fulfilled his potential because of injury and all the rest of it. He had all of the tools to be a difficult-to-play fast bowler, but the flashes of brilliance came few and far between for me. Real shame for him that he wasn't able to have the kind of career I think his talent probably deserved. I think that would be my take on it, and good luck to him with whatever he does next. And, my big memory was him turning up at Scarborough in the middle of summer when it was about 22, 23 degrees and he got a woolly hat on.
I mean, his moment, his purple patch was the 10-11 series, wasn't it? And he was brilliant. But after that, I've watched him in county cricket and good grief, he's almost past the ball because he's so slow these days. Fair play to him. He had a brilliant Ashes win down under and no one can take them away from him.
Absolutely.
But it's probably the right decision for him to go because he's ineffective at the moment.
My very final thing I want to mention is that this week I was run out for a duck by my own captain. This is the state that cricket has got to in the Lancashire Leagues. That's it. Anything else anybody wants to mention or shall we wrap it up there?
Let's wrap it up.
Yeah, done.
I've not mentioned the Y word, have I?
No.
What's the Y word?
No, let's not do it. Let's leave it there. And from Lancashire... And that why
champion.
Not yet.
We'll leave it there, and we'll be back with another one. If you want to get in touch with us, we'd much appreciate it. That's at The Drinks Break on Twitter. And thank you for all your questions. We do appreciate it. Please spread the word. This is The Drinks Break.